Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob. Reading today from John Owen's The Mortification of Sin. We're on chapter 6 of the book, and it goes like this. What is it, what it is to mortify a sin in general, which will make farther way for particular directions, is nextly to be considered. What is it? Well, the mortification of a lust consists in three things. First, a habitual weakening of it. Every lust is a depraved habit or disposition, continually inclining the heart to evil. Thence is that description of him who hath no lust truly mortified, Genesis 6:5. Every imagination of the thoughts of his heart is only evil continually. He's always under the power of a strong bent and inclination to sin. And the reason why a natural man is not always perpetually in the pursuit of someone lust night and day is because he hath many to serve, every one crying out to be satisfied. Thence he's carried on with great variety, but still in general he lies toward the satisfaction of self. We will suppose then the lust or distemper whose mortification is inquired after to be in itself a strong, deeply rooted, habitual inclination and bent of will and affections unto some actual sin. As to the matter of it, though not under that formal consideration, always stirring up imaginations, thoughts, contrivances about the object of it. Hence, men are said to have their hearts set upon evil. The bent of their spirits lies toward it to make provision for the flesh. And a sinful, depraved habit, as in many other things, so in this, differs from all natural or moral habits whatever. For whereas they incline the soul gently and suitably to itself, sinful habits impel with violence and impetuousness, whence lusts are said to fight or wage war against the soul, 1 Peter 2:11, to rebel or rise up in war with that conduct and opposition which is usual therein, Romans 7:23, to lead captive or effectually captivating upon success in battle, all works of great violence and impetuousness. I might manifest fully from that description that we have of it, Romans 7, how it will darken the mind, extinguish convictions, dethrone reason, interrupt the power and influence of any considerations that may be brought to hamper it, and break through all into a flame. But this is not my present business. Now, the first thing in mortification is the weakening of this habit of sin or lust, that it shall not, with that violence, earnestness, frequency, rise up, conceive, tumultuate, provoke, entice, disquiet, as naturally it is apt to do, James 1:14-15. I shall desire to give one caution or rule by the way, and it is this. Though every lust doth in its own nature equally, universally, incline and impel to sin, yet this must be granted with these two limitations. First, one lust, or a lust in one man, may receive many accidental improvements, heightenings, strengthenings, which may give it life, power, and vigor, exceedingly above what another lust hath, or the same lust, that is, of the same kind and nature, in another man. When a lust falls in with the natural constitutions and temper, with a suitable course of life, with occasions, or when Satan hath got a fit handle to it, to manage it, as he hath a thousand ways to do so, that lust grows violent and impetuous above others, or more than the same lust in another man. Then the seams of it darken the mind so that though a man knows the same things as formerly, yet they have no power nor influence on the will, but corrupt affections and passions are set by it at liberty. But especially, lust gets strength by temptation. When a suitable temptation falls in with a lust, it gives it a new life, vigor, power, violence, and rage, which it seemed not before to have or to be capable of. Instances to this purpose might be multiplied, but it is the design of some part of another treatise to evince this observation. And secondly, some lusts are far more sensible and discernible in their violent acting than others. Paul puts a difference between uncleanness and all other sins. In 1 Corinthians 6:18, it says, "Flee fornication. Every sin that a man doeth is without the body, but he that committeth fornication sinneth against his own body." Hence, the motions of that sin are more sensible, more discernible than of others. When perhaps the love of the world or the like is in a person no less habitually predominant than that, yet it makes not so great a combustion in the whole man. And on this account, some men may go on in their own thoughts and in the eyes of the world for mortified men, who yet have in them no less predominancy of lust than those who cry out with astonishment upon the account of its perplexing tumultuatings. Yea, than those who have by the power of it been hurried into scandalous sins. Only their lusts are in and about things which raise not such a tumult in the soul, about which they are exercised with a calmer frame of spirit, the very fabric of nature being not so nearly concerned in them as in some other. I say then that the first thing in mortification is the weakening of this habit, that it shall not impel and tumultuate as formerly, that it shall not entice and draw aside, that it shall not disquiet and perplex the killing of its life, vigor, promptness, and readiness to be stirring. This is called crucifying the flesh with the lusts thereof, Galatians 5:24. That is, taking away its blood and spirits that give it strength and power, the wasting of the body of death day by day, 2 Corinthians 4:16. As a man nailed to the cross, He first struggles and strives. He cries out with great strength and might, but as his blood and spirits waste, his strivings are faint and seldom, his cries low and hoarse, scarce to be heard. When a man first sets on a lust or distemper to deal with it, it struggles with great violence to break loose. It cries with earnestness and impatience to be satisfied and relieved. But when by mortification the blood and spirits of it are let out, it moves seldom and faintly. It cries sparingly. It is scarce heard in the heart. It may have sometimes a dying pang that makes an appearance of great vigor and strength, but it's quickly over, especially if it be kept from considerable success. This the apostle describes, as in the whole chapter, and so especially Romans 6:6. Sin, he says, is crucified. It is fastened to the cross. To what end? That the body of death may be destroyed, the power of sin weakened and abolished by little and little, that henceforth we should not serve sin. That is, that sin might not incline or impel us with such efficacy as to make us servants to it, as it has done heretofore. And this is spoken not only with respect to carnal and sensual affections or the desires of worldly things, not only in respect of the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, but also as to the flesh, that is, in the mind and will, in that opposition unto God, which is in us by nature. Of what nature soever the troubling distemper be, by what ways soever it make itself out, either by impelling to evil or hindering from that which is good, the rule is the same. And unless this be done effectually, all after contention will not compass the end aimed at. A man may beat down the bitter fruit from an evil tree until he is weary, but while the root abides in strength and vigor, the beating down of the present fruit will not hinder it from bringing forth more. This is the folly of some men. They set themselves with all earnestness and diligence against the appearing eruption of lust, but leaving the principle and root untouched, and perhaps unsearched out. They make but little or no progress in this work of mortification. And then in constant fighting and contending against sin, to be able, always, to be laying load on sin is no small degree of mortification. When sin is strong and vigorous, the soul is scarce able to make any head against it. It sighs and groans and mourns and is troubled, as David speaks of himself, but seldom has sin in the pursuit. David complains that his sin had taken fast hold upon him, that he could not look up. Psalm 40, verse 12. How little, then, was he able to fight against it? Now, as sundry things are required unto and comprised in this fighting against sin, first to know that a man has such an enemy to deal withal, and to take notice of it, to consider it as an enemy indeed, and one that is to be destroyed by all means possible, that is required hereunto. As I said before, the contest is vigorous and hazardous. It is about the things of eternity. When, therefore, men have slight and transient thoughts of their lusts, it's no great sign that they're mortified, or that they are in a way for their mortification. This is every man's knowing the plague of his own heart, 1 Kings 8:38. Without which no other work can be done. It is to be feared that very many have little knowledge of the main enemy that they carry about with them in their bosoms. This makes them ready to justify themselves and to be impatient of reproof or admonition, not knowing that they are in any danger. 2 Chronicles 16:10. And then, second, to labor and to be acquainted with the ways, the wiles, the methods, advantages, and occasions of its success. That's the beginning of this warfare. So do men deal with enemies. They inquire out their counsels and designs. They ponder their ends. They consider how and by what means they have formerly prevailed, that they may be prevented. In this consists the greatest skill in conduct. Take this away, and all waging of war, wherein is the greatest improvement of human wisdom and industry, would be brutish. So do they deal with lust to mortify it indeed. Not only when it is actually vexing and enticing and seducing, but in their retirements, they consider, this is our enemy. This is his way and progress. These are his advantages. Thus hath he prevailed, and thus he will do, if not prevented. And so David says, my sin is ever before me, Psalm 51:3. And indeed, one of the choicest and most eminent parts of practically spiritual wisdom consists in finding out the subtleties, the policies, the depths of any indwelling sin, to consider and know wherein its greatest strength lies. What advantage it uses to make of occasions, opportunities, temptations. What are its pleas, pretenses, reasonings? What are its stratagems, colors, excuses? To set the wisdom of the Spirit against the craft of the old man. To trace this serpent in all its turnings and windings. And to be able to say, at its most secret and, to a common frame of heart, imperceptible actings, this is your old way and course. I know what you aim at. And so to be always in readiness is a good part of our warfare. Thirdly, to load it daily with all the things which shall after be mentioned that are grievous, killing, and destructive to sin. That's the height of this contest. Such a one never thinks his lust dead because it is quiet, but labors still to give it new wounds, new blows every day. And so did the Apostle, Colossians 3:5. Now, whilst the soul is in this condition, whilst it is thus dealing, it is certainly uppermost. Sin is under the sword and dying. And then thirdly, in success. I keep saying first and second and third, and you don't know which is which because I keep repeating the numbers. But he has different divisions here. He starts with a one in parentheses, and then he has to break that down to a one and two in brackets. Then he comes back to the parentheses two and so on. But this is the final of the 3 points he wanted to make about the mortification of a lust. It consists in three things. First, he said it was a habitual weakening of it. Secondly, let me find that parentheses two, it was in constant fighting and contending against it. And thirdly, in success, frequent success against any lust is another part and evidence of mortification. By success, I understand not a mere disappointment of sin, that it be not brought forth nor accomplished, but a victory over it and pursuit of it to a complete conquest. For instance, when the heart finds sin at any time at work, seducing, forming imaginations to make provision for the flesh, to fulfill the lusts of it, it instantly apprehends sin, brings it to the law of God and love of Christ, and condemns it, and follows it with execution to the uttermost. Ah, that's good, huh? Now I say, when a man comes to this state and condition, that lust is weakened in the root and principle, that its motions and actions are fewer and weaker than formerly, so that they are not able to hinder his duty nor interrupt his peace. When he can, in a quiet, sedate frame of spirit, find out and fight against sin and have success against it, then sin is mortified in some considerable measure. And notwithstanding all its opposition, a man may have peace with God all his days. So unto these heads, then, do I refer the mortification aimed at, that is, of any one perplexing distemper, whereby the general pravity and corruption of our nature attempts to exert and put forth itself. He's going to summarize now. First, the weakening of its indwelling disposition, whereby it inclines, entices, impels to evil, rebels, opposes, fights against God by the implanting habitual residence and cherishing of a principle of grace that stands in direct opposition to it and is destructive of it, is the foundation of it. So by the implanting and growth of humility is pride weakened, passion by patience, uncleanness by purity of mind and conscience, love of this world by heavenly mindedness, which are graces of the Spirit, or the same habitual grace variously acting itself by the Holy Ghost, according to the variety or diversity of the objects about which it is exercised, as the other are several lusts, or the same natural corruption variously acting itself, according to the various advantages and occasions that it meets withal. Now, the promptness, alacrity, vigor of the spirit, the second thing, or new man, in contending with, cheerful fighting against, the lust spoken of, by all the ways and with all the means that are appointed thereto, which he hasn't totally told us yet, by the way. Constantly using the sukkars provided against its motions and actings is a second thing hereunto required. And then success unto several degrees attends these two. Now this, if the distemper hath not an unconquerable advantage from its natural situation, may possibly be to such a universal conquest as the soul may never more sensibly feel its opposition, and shall, however, assuredly rise to an allowance of peace to the conscience, according to the tenor of the covenant of grace. Wow, okay, that was chapter 6. So you get the beginnings of it now, right? Be aware of what's going on. That was one big thing. Get a success going here. That'll surprise the sin in you. get some regular stuff going on and use the means that he's going to show us, and you know some of them already, Bible study and prayer and whatever, to conquer these things when they first appear. Well, that's just the intro still. We're going to get to the meat of it soon. God bless you for being here, and please come back. And before you go, maybe you'll want to check out a study on the Quran and Muhammad, perhaps a Through the Bible course, some studies on prophecy, studies on the doctrines of grace, long, long series on North Korea. A lot of stuff on here that I hope you will avail yourself of. Lord bless you. This is the Hackberry House of Chosun. Lord willing, we will talk very soon. Bye-bye.